Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santamaria, and my guest tonight is Sean Carroll. Sean's a theoretical physicist at Caltech who's written two popular science books, From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time, and more recently, The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. Sean's blog is called Preposterous Universe, and he's contributed to it regularly since 2004. Now, you may notice that partway through this episode, Sean alludes to a major announcement that was made this past Monday, March 17th, 2014. Although in the episode, he says, this coming Monday. And that's not because we spent the hour time traveling. I wish that were the case, but it's actually because we recorded this podcast a little over a week ago. In fact, the announcement that he refers to has major implications for understanding our universe. If the results of the BICEP 2 experiment that he references actually do hold up, scientists may be glimpsing back at the earliest moments of our universe yet. I mean, we're talking a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. And this discovery could confirm the inflationary theory that Sean and I talk about later in the episode. Now, if you want to learn more about this amazing discovery, just Google BICEP 2, gravitational waves, or even inflation, and check out the news surrounding those search terms. Or you could just go to preposterousuniverse.com. Sean explains this stuff a hell of a lot better than most. All right, guys, it's time to talk nerdy. Sean, thank you so much for joining me today to talk nerdy.
My pleasure to be here.
I'm so excited. So I want to kind of get into physics because a lot of people have been asking me, you know, you're a science podcast and we haven't heard any science yet. It's been a lot of politics so far, which is also another love of mine. But before we get into the nitty gritty, I wanted to talk a little bit about how we first met.
Oh, yeah.
It's always fun for me to think about that. Yeah, so Science Online, this was a kind of a conference, a meeting of the minds of a lot of science communicators, not just scientists, but people who like to share about science, whether it's through writing, on air, through podcasting even. And I knew who you were. I mean, I knew of you as a physicist and as an author. And I remember sitting down at a table in some session. I was new to the Science Online experience. Yeah. I think you were a veteran. And you sat down next to me and said hi, introduced yourself, and I like did not put two and two together. And then after you left, I was like, oh my God, that was Sean Carroll.
I knew who you were, but I didn't know who you were because my lovely wife Jennifer knew who you were and had mentioned you before, but I didn't put two and two together either. So, but you were clearly like the lost little kitten at the Science Online convention because you didn't know anyone there. I had actually never been there before.
Oh, you
myself,
weren't a veteran.
But I knew the people. I was sort of a veteran of the community and so forth. So I could act like I knew what was going on, even though I had no more idea than you did.
So funny. Yeah, I was actually kind of scared, but it was such a great community. And eventually it became a group of my good friends, who I still to this day like to spend time with. Jason Goldman, who is a science writer who lives out here in Los Angeles, and I will be doing a podcast with him soon. He kind of focuses on animal cognition. He really took me under his wing, and we became like really good friends. And
he's
so,
a great guy, right?
He's such a great guy. And so since then, we spent a lot of time together. We actually had a viewing party for Cosmos recently at his house on Sunday night, which was a lot of fun. And you mentioned your lovely wife, Jennifer. And just so that you guys at home know, I'm actually interviewing both Sean and Jennifer today. I'm doing a twofer, so you can look forward to her podcast coming out very, very soon.
You know, I once was interviewed by a journalist for the New York Times, big, you know, my first book was coming out, big profile interview. And at the end of the interview, she says, you know, I interview a lot of scientists and they never talk about their wives as much as you do.
I was actually going to ask you about that too. It's funny because it's a note that I have on my notes for Jennifer, but I want to ask you, you know, I personally am very quiet, I guess I could say, about my relationships. And it could be because I'm not married. So, you know, when I fall in love, as much as I really hope that it's going to last forever, you don't know if it will. And I'm just not quite ready to invite the public into my private life in that way. So generally speaking, fans, followers, listeners don't know if I'm in a relationship or not because I'm very kind of hush-hush about it.
you are really open. I mean, you and Jennifer, I'd say, are kind of like science's power couple. I think a lot of people think of you that way. What gives you that level of comfort? Or when did you first decide kind of, yeah, I'm going to talk about this?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's a combination of things. I mean, I think by temperament, we are both much more like you, like not that interested in having anyone knowing anything about our private lives or relationships or anything. But number one, we're both, you know, out there in the science communication public sphere. People know who we are. Literally, we met because we were reading each other's blogs. That's how we met for the first time.
Oh my God, that's so cute. That's like the nerdiest, loveliest.
Exactly,
I love it.
Right. And, you know, also once you find someone and get married and are sure that this is what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life, you are much more open about talking about it. So I actually don't know if we did let anyone know online that we were together until on our blogs we mentioned that we were getting married. So, you know, but after that point, you know, the cat's out of the bag. And
of course. And how long have you been married now?
We got married in 2007.
Oh, wow.
So that's 7 years.
7 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's such a, I feel like it's such a match made in heaven, because a lot of times, you know, when I was in college, I remember dating other scientists, like people who were in my lab or people who were in neighboring labs. And sometimes that was contentious a little bit, you know, it kind of became difficult, but you are a physicist. Jennifer, by trade, was a writer, and now you guys both write about physics, but you kind of probably come at it from different approaches, and you get to sort of complement each other
exactly.
That way.
Exactly. It's very complimentary, very teamworky, very non-overlappy. I mean, I certainly have friends who are scientists married to other scientists, and I don't get it. That's a little bit too much for me.
To me, that's like
they write papers together, and
it's like an atheist marrying a Christian or something. I don't understand it. I mean, no disrespect to anybody, but I couldn't do it. Or like a Democrat marrying a Republican.
Then again, I will also mention that Jennifer did swear never to date a physicist, and then, you know, you can't swear to these things. It's finding the right person that matters, not finding
apparently
the right occupation.
So you have a new-ish book, your newest book, I should say, that's out is, it's The Particle at the End of the Universe, right? That's your newest.
That's right.
And so that book is about the Higgs boson, which was a huge news story about a year to two, about a year ago, right?
2012 it was found.
Okay, 2012. So about a year and a half ago probably now. And that was a big news story kind of leading up to the announcement. It was a big news story during the announcement. And it was one of those amazing times in science, I think, where something is newsworthy both inside the scientific community, but also outside of the scientific community. But it was also one of those very difficult times where a lot of people reporting on the story had no idea what they were talking about, because it's a complicated topic. I remember doing a piece when I was working for the Huffington Post. I was their science correspondent, and I did this video series called Talk Nerdy to Me. And one of the pieces I did was on the Higgs. And these are 5-minute videos, right? So I was very, I had a lot of time pressure on me. I sat down on a Skype call, actually, with Henry Reich, the man behind Minute Physics on YouTube. If you don't know about it, you should watch it because it's amazing. And he really helped me because I was trying to come up with a good analogy. And I decided I don't have the expertise to really talk about what the Higgs boson does. Instead, I want to talk about why this type of discovery is so important. And so I came up with this analogy that you're working on a bomb squad, and there's a bomb that goes off in a city, and everything's kind of blown to smithereens. And now you're trying to figure out who built that bomb, how that bomb was built, and what all of its component parts are. And you've probably collected the wreckage from like 75-80% of the bomb. You have a good idea that there's this one wire that's missing, and you have a good idea how it would work to build the bomb, but you haven't found it yet. So you kind of know it exists, or you think it exists, and you're pretty sure it works in this one particular way because that makes your whole model make sense. But since you haven't yet found it, you can't say with any certainty that's what the bomb would look like. And who knows? Let's say you find this wire and electrons flow backward in it, or instead of energy, it's actually got liquid candy flowing through it. You don't know until you find it. So you could actually be opening the door to all sorts of crazy possibilities. But truth be told, it's probably just a regular wire, and eventually you're going to find it. Does that make sense coming from a non-physicist, kind of using that sort of an analogy, which is the Higgs boson physicists have long thought exists. They just haven't been able to find it yet. And it's not like the missing thing. It's not like the groundbreaking thing in physics. It's just they hadn't found it yet.
Well, I think that's a very good analogy. I have a very similar one that I'll tell you in a second. But
first,
I want to agree that the importance of the Higgs boson was absolutely crucial because mm-hmm. to confess, the idea of writing The Particle at the End of the Universe was not mine. It was actually my editor's idea. And I am not a science writer. I mean, I'm a person who writes about science. I am a scientist. But my goal in life is not to find cool science things and write about them.
Yeah.
It's to do science. And the books that I write are generally going to be about ideas that I have and I'm thinking about myself. But this one was not. It was more almost journalism there.
Yeah.
And so my first inclination was to say no when the editor suggested that I write a book about the Higgs boson.
Interesting.
But he talked me into it, and I talked myself into it because, I mean, his basic point was correct. It was a major, important, history-making moment in the history of physics. It was going to be, because we started talking about it before they found it. And it was hard to explain, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, of all these major things that we find, explaining why the Higgs boson is a big deal might be one of the biggest challenges. So a book written by a physicist that really tries to help people explain what the Higgs is and why it is so important, I thought was worth doing. And so my version of the missing wire analogy is a card trick. You see, you know, you're on the street and you see someone, a street magician, doing card tricks. And there's this one trick he has where he makes a card float in the air.
Okay.
And so you're looking at the card trick and you see the card float in the air. And, you know, you've been around a little bit. You haven't seen this trick, but you've seen other similar ones. And you come up with a way he probably was doing it involving a little invisible wire, just like, you know, your wire in the bomb. So there's a little invisible wire. And so you go home and you practice it and you can do it yourself. And you're like, yes, I'm pretty sure that this is a way to make the card float in exactly that way. But until you actually see the guy doing the trick and see the wire yourself, you're not sure that that's the way he did it.
Totally. It could be a completely other kind of sleight of hand, trick of the eye.
Exactly. And before we found the Higgs boson, we knew that the effects we attribute to the Higgs boson were there. It breaks symmetries. There's a field that fills space. It gives mass to other particles. So we had a theory. We had a theory of the trick. Nature is pulling a trick on us. We had a way that it could be done. But until you actually see for sure, you're not absolutely certain that you're on the right track.
So what I want to do is I want to kind of take a beat, step back a little bit, and start not from the ultimate beginning, not like Sheldon Cooper, you know, once upon a time we gazed at the stars. Yeah. But I do want to kind of take a step back for people whose minds are already blown and are already a little bit confused about what's going on and talk about kind of how the Higgs fits in. And of course, as you said, you're a theoretical physicist, you're an astrophysicist. Your focus of research at Caltech has been cosmology, field theory, gravitation, quantum mechanics. So the Higgs does fit in to some extent, but that's, you haven't specifically focused on the Higgs yourself as a researcher.
Exactly right.
Yeah. But you've probably had access to amazing physicists and been able to talk about this with so many interesting people. And at least you have the background to really understand. I mean, you studied this. You studied it in school.
Being a journalist is hard.
Yeah.
And I know that being a journalist is hard, but you know, it was rubbed in my face when I was trying to write the book because, you know, the parts explaining how the Higgs boson works, I could whip off. I mean, it's work to get the best possible explanation, but that's what I do. And that's what I liked doing. But then interviewing other physicists for hours on Skype or whatever and getting them to say interesting things, it's just not in my toolbox right now, and I never want it to be.
It's not easy.
It's not easy. You know?
We probably see Jennifer over in the corner, like rolling
exactly.
her eyes.
Jennifer's
like, oh,
laughing.
Yeah, not easy.
Yeah. Right.
So I do want to back up a little bit. And when we talk about the Higgs, we're talking about, for example, what's a boson? How does this fit into our understanding of the universe?
Well, the one sentence explanation of why understanding the Higgs boson is difficult for us mm-hmm. is because it's not the Higgs boson that is really that big a deal. What's really a big deal is what we call the Higgs field.
Okay.
A field that fills all of empty space. So when physicists throw around the word field, what they simply mean is that there's something that exists everywhere. It's not like a planet or a particle that has a certain location in space. It's an invisible energy field that has a value at every point in space. So the gravitational field is the thing that surrounds the Earth and the stars and so forth. And at every point in the universe, there is a value. It could be zero, but the gravitational field is doing something.
So this is something that's intangible in some ways. It's just something that other things act upon.
Well, so the secret of physics that we haven't told you, mm-hmm. that you eventually, the only way to figure it out is to read my book, is that everything in the universe is made of fields. So even the things that we think of as particles, like electrons or neutrinos or quarks, these are vibrations in quantum mechanical fields. There's a quark field. There's six different kinds of quark fields, up, down, etc. There's an electron field, a neutrino field. And then for every force of nature, there's a field. There's the gravitational field. There's the electric field, the magnetic field. And then there's the Higgs field. And so the Higgs field is unique. Before the Higgs, every field that we'd ever found, corresponding to every particle we'd ever found, was either a matter field, like the stuff that makes up atoms and you and me, or a force field. And the matter fields are called fermions, after Enrico Fermi. The force fields are called bosons, after Professor Bose, whose first name I cannot pronounce.
And these are things that I think are... A little bit easier to grasp as somebody who doesn't have a strong background in physics, because we can see matter, we can touch matter, we can manipulate matter. The concept of matter is an easier one to swallow. And then the idea of force is something that we remember from elementary school physics, you know, doing experiments so that we can see different forces. We can play around with gravity. We can play around with centripetal force or with friction or all of these different things. So those kinds of things sort of make sense to us. Mm-hmm. How does the Higgs field fit into that kind of understanding that we might have?
Well, there's a huge difference, which is crucial as to why the Higgs is so special, which is that the fields that we know and love, whether they're particles of matter or force fields, you can turn them off. You know, in empty space, you can imagine going to a place in the universe where everything is quiet, there's no gravity, there's no light, there's no matter, and you can say, look, the fields are all set to zero. They're just sitting there. And the Higgs field is special because even in empty space, it has a huge value. It is not zero. So unlike all the other fields, which you can ignore if you were truly in empty space, the Higgs field exerts an influence on everything that moves through it. Every particle is affected by the fact that it moves through the Higgs field as it moves through the universe. So as you walk down the street every day, you are moving through Higgs field. And thank goodness, because the effect that it has is to make the particles that we know about a little heavier. Okay. More ponderous, right? Mm-hmm. So if it weren't for the Higgs field, if it weren't there, or if it were there but its value were zero, so you didn't feel it as you walked through the room, then the electrons that are responsible for all the chemistry in your body would be massless. Right now they have a really tiny mass, but it's not zero, but they would be zero mass. And Einstein says that if you're zero mass, you move at the speed of light.
Yes.
So if it weren't for the Higgs field, electrons would move at the speed of light. That means they wouldn't make atoms, right? They wouldn't settle in
to make atoms or molecules. We would be teeny tiny pieces spread out across the universe.
Well, we wouldn't exist because the atoms of which we're made could never form. You would just have a soup, a thin gruel of particles zipping along at the speed of light. There'd be no atoms, no chemistry, no biology, no life.
Wow. And that's it reminds me of a line from the original Cosmos that Carl Sagan said. And if you are new to Cosmos, you may have seen the wonderful Melody Sheep song. If you remember the Symphony of Science, you can look him up on YouTube. He does these great kind of auto-tune versions of great scientists. And he also clips out this quote there, but it's from the original Cosmos when Carl Sagan says, "The beauty of the universe is not the atoms that go into it, but the way those atoms are put together." And there's so much kind of, I don't want to use the word magic because I don't mean it in the true sense of the word magic, but there's so much awe, right. I think, in the way that all of these different subcomponents, these particles, these subatomic particles, come together to form the basic building blocks of not just life, but of all matter, right?
I've decided that wonder is a better word than awe, because awe is sort of a passive thing. You're just like, wow, that's amazing. They're both good words, but I
wonder
like wonder because it's like, I wonder what's going on there, you know? But you're absolutely right in that, you know, the complexity of the world around us, the single most amazing thing about it is how it arises from so few simple pieces, right?
Yeah.
And this is the triumph of Democritus and the other Greek atomists, right? Lucretius and Epicurus and those guys. I mean, they said, look, you know, all the stuff around us and all of its splendor and all of its organization can be boiled down to arrangements of a few simple pieces. And to a very large extent, that's something that a lot of human beings are resistant to buying into,
completely.
Right? The idea that the world around us is made of matter, doing things, obeying the laws of physics, that being alive is a property that matter can have. It's not a separate thing that comes in and animates matter. And that's why, you know, in the bigger picture, I think that the kind of fundamental physics discoveries we make are continuous with questions we have about our place in the universe. And I don't want to isolate physics questions from questions of meaning and purpose.
And I think that's an important point to make. And I think that the reason that sometimes those things feel so separate, because as you said, this really informs the way that we understand our role and the way that we kind of come to terms with whatever our religious or our spiritual place is, whether it's an atheistic view or a theistic view. You have to kind of you have to come to terms with this understanding if you want to be somebody who is informed about the true nature of the universe. But I think sometimes that physics feels distinct because the nomenclature involved, because the mathematics involved feels somewhat out of reach to an everyday person, whereas they can look at something like evolution, which I think is a more kind of glaring difficulty. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very obvious problem to say, if I believe that I was created in God's image, for example, I am not comfortable with the idea that there were many transitional forms between myself and an ape-like ancestor, between the ape-like ancestor and the fish that walked on land, and between ultimately going back to bacteria, right? That's a very difficult thing to swallow. When it comes to physics, which we're kind of saying something very similar, we're just looking at even smaller building blocks. That feels so distinct. It feels like there's such a big span of time between, or not of time, but of space between my understanding of who I am and my sense of self and subatomic particles, that it's easier for people to just kind of flip that switch, turn the light off and say, oh, that's out of my realm of understanding.
No, I think that's very true. And also I would add to that the fact that scientists, and physicists in particular, are trained to focus narrowly on the technical problems they're trying to solve rather than being boisterously philosophical and grandiose and connecting it to bigger questions of life. And so the biologists, sadly, have not been able to get away with that because the question of evolution speaks right to our notion of who we are as human beings. The physicists have been able to get away with it. But what I've noticed is that as I give popular talks about cosmology and, you know, you show pictures of all the galaxies out there and so forth, or even about physics, particle physics, and say, look, you know, there are laws of physics. We now know all of the particles that you're made of. And we know all of the rules that they obey. There are other particles that we don't know, but those particles aren't inside you. We know that, you know, to more than beyond reasonable doubt levels of confidence. So if you let people ask questions and don't resist it, you know, if people say, well, you know, what does that mean? And so forth, the first physicist's reaction is, no, don't worry about that. Look at this pretty equation that I can show you. But if you let them ask the questions naturally, they do very quickly go to these bigger picture questions. And so I am of the opinion that we should let them do that, and we should not shy away from drawing those connections.
And I think that it's, I'm somebody who has a bit of scientific training. You know, I have a master's degree in neurobiology. I started a PhD in clinical neuropsychology, but I left that to kind of pursue science communication out here on the best coast. So I have this background. It really started with psychology and moved into neuroscience through kind of a biological pathway. So what I'm really lacking is a strong basis in physics and chemistry. I took one physics class in college, and it was an astronomy class, specifically stellar astronomy. But I remember a whole unit being kind of dedicated to this concept of, is there an edge of the universe? Is the universe infinite? What does that mean for me? And how do I relate to the expanses of the universe? And I think that that was really important, especially as basically a physics for non-majors course, because those are the kinds of questions that are going to inspire a real interest in physics. And maybe there will be a handful of people in that class who go, this is fascinating. I want to learn this at a deeper level. Or you have people who are going to become journalists or whatever they're going to do, psychologists, marketing directors, business folks, and they never actually get back into it. But they had that one course where they got to explore answers to those really big picture questions, which I don't think we should kind of hold on to and say, oh, that's for when you get to your senior kind of colloquium, and that's when you're allowed to talk about
this. I think everyone who graduates from high school should know the basic particles of which were made, the basic forces, and should know that that picture is enough to explain every single thing you have ever seen with your eyeballs, touched with your fingers, heard with your ears, etc. And they should know that the universe is about 14 billion years old, began in a hot Big Bang, and it's going to keep expanding and cooling and get emptier and emptier and lonelier and lonelier.
And I mean, that's one of those things that I think a lot of people don't realize. When I was working on my master's, I started teaching. And that's really why I made this transition more into SciComm and into doing the things that I like to do, is because I found myself less and less wanting to spend time in the lab and more prepping for my courses. And when I taught freshman biology, I mean, Bio 101, we basically covered almost everything that any advanced biologist is going to study in their field. We just covered it at a very basic level. And I know it's the same for chemistry. It's the same for physics. When you take your intro courses, you actually get a healthy dose of pretty much the entire field. You just aren't digging as deep as you would as you start to focus on these little subcompartments.
Except that might not be true for physics.
Is it really?
It might be more true for biology or chemistry. But so I think that it's kind of sad that what we teach, usually what we teach non-physics majors, is just a watered-down version of the first course we teach for physics majors.
Okay.
Which is by no means getting to the fun stuff, right?
Really? It's like, old, oh, these are the planets.
Yeah, I know. In a one-year intro physics course, you know, you don't get past the mid-19th century.
Wow. Yeah, that to me is crazy. It's crazy to teach physics the way that you teach history. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't teach science and history. Like, when I was a psych major, we took a history of psychological science, and that was a great course because we really got to understand this field of psychology was born out of these types of discoveries, and this school of thought thought this, and then we advanced to this school of thought, and we combined these things. And I think that's fundamentally important. When you're really focused on a school of thought, you have to kind of understand how it came to be and why it came to be. But to start that way with kids who have no access to science, and this is their only time that they're probably going to be able to taste physics,
right?
Why would you feed them Brussels sprouts? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense to me either. But so good. We agree. Once we're put in charge, the world will change.
Yay. All right. So I want to talk, though, about your newest book, actually. Or we did just talk about your newest book. I want to talk about the book that you did right before that, which I actually have a copy of right here, because you forgot to sign my copy. Tisk,
well,
tisk.
All right. If this goes well, then we'll see what we can do.
And so this, I actually interviewed you again for the HuffPost segment that I used to do, and we talked a bit about time. We actually submitted it. Ultimately, we didn't win, unfortunately, but we did submit it to the Flame Challenge, right? Which is Alan Alda's really cool thing where he's looking for a very basic, like, could you explain this to a middle school student? Could you explain the concept? The first time was of a flame.
Right.
Teach a middle school student how flame works. And then he decided to do one about time, because time to me is one of those concepts that this is like mind-blowing stuff where when you don't really think too deeply about it, it's just completely understandable, fundamental. It's a scaffolding that we build our lives upon. And of course, time is time. You know, there's hours and minutes and seconds and months and years, and that's just how it is. And it keeps us sane. But the minute that you start kind of deconstructing the concept of time, maybe you've hit the pipe a little too hard, maybe something's going on in your life, and you really start thinking about these things in a deeper kind of questioning way, all of a sudden the concept of time can really F with you.
That's right.
And so this was a question that I was really interested in pursuing with you, which was, is the concept of time a real thing? Is it something that we as human beings invent in order to parse out our days and our years so that we can understand and we can show up, you know, to meetings at the same time as the other person? Or is this something that's fundamental to the basic kind of building blocks of physics itself?
Yeah, I think that, you know, so speaking as the professor now, there are three possibilities, and we know that one of them is not right. One possibility is that time is absolutely fundamental, by which I would mean that no matter how you tried to discuss what happens in the universe, you would find that something, either time or something equivalent to it, was an absolutely crucial ingredient in that description that you had. You couldn't do without it. Another possibility is that time is emergent, so that there are other ways of talking about the universe that maybe are even more fundamental, and that time is a sort of a useful approximation,
okay.
Like the temperature of the air in the room. We used to think that was a fundamental thing, but now that we know that air is made of molecules and atoms, we can derive temperature from a more deep description. Maybe time is like that. And the final possibility is that time is just something that is made up by human perception. And I think that that third possibility is just wrong. It's, you know, it's not something that we human beings have invented. It's either an exact or an approximately useful concept in talking about the universe. We don't know whether the final laws of physics will include time as a crucial ingredient. I think it's completely possible that they will, completely possible that they won't. Among my best friends, I have strong proponents on either side. So don't believe anyone who says that it is or isn't. But I think that, yeah, it's a very good question. Until we know what the final laws of physics look like, it'll be hard to answer it definitively.
And so do you think that if it is somewhere kind of in between, that it's some sort of emergent property that then we make use of, do you think that our approximations of time are well in sync with any sort of universal clock? Or do you think that we've kind of just invented something that works best for us? Because cross-culturally, I think that there are components to time that are very similar, but there are also things that are wildly different, especially when you start looking at kind of annual calendars. They vary, you know, from the right. Jewish calendar to the Mayan calendar to the modern calendar. They vary a lot, but this concept of like seconds or hours or minutes or even days. Days is probably the easiest one, right? Because it gets dark and then it gets light again.
We
all have days.
Yeah, I think it's another good question, and it comes into the difference between the sort of physical and the psychological or experiential aspects of time, both of which are really important. And so there's time, there's how we measure time, and there's how we experience time. And these three things are all very, very different. So time, as you know, we think about it on a day-to-day basis, there's no question it exists, it's real, it's crucial. You know, when people act as if time is something very mysterious, I like to say, look, if someone tells you your TV show starts at 8 p.m., you know what that means. You're not seized with existential dread going like, oh my God, this mysterious concept, I have no idea what 8 p.m. could possibly refer to. No, we all can deal with that, right? And so there it is. Time is there. It's useful. It's real. But and we can measure it, but measuring it turns out to be kind of a trick that the universe lets us in on, because you measure time using clocks. And what is a clock? A clock is something that does the same thing over and over again in a predictable way with respect to other clocks.
Hmm.
So the Earth, you know, you see the sun rising and setting.
So that is a clock.
And that, well, it's a clock only because you know it's going to happen 365 and a quarter times every time we go around the sun. It's with respect to something else that it makes it a clock. And so that sounds like a circular definition, but we live in a universe that's full of clocks, a universe that has things vibrating and oscillating and going in circles in predictable ways compared to other things. Very rarely perfectly predictable, which is why timekeeping is a bit of a challenge, but, you know, predictable enough to let us go on with our lives. And then there is the experience of time. And that really gets into, you know, how the brain works more than anything else. If time goes faster for you when you're excited and slower when you're on a boring airplane ride, I tell people, you know, that's your fault. That's not physics's fault.
Yeah.
You know, the time itself is not actually speeding up. But the neuroscientists have done amazing things in figuring out how we do experience time and relating it to, for example, things like the rate at which we get new memories implanted in our brains. So if you think that as an older person, the summertime when you're having fun goes by a lot quicker than it used to when you were 8 years old and playing at the beach. It does. I mean, it does in your experience, because when you're 8 years old and you're going to the beach for the first time, everything is new.
Yeah.
And it's like a new experience. It's implanted on your brain. It stays with you for a long time. When you're mumbledy-mumble how years old, then, you know, you've been there before, right? And it's fun, you don't feel as many new experiences. And in fact, people try to quantify it. They say that, you know, the rate at which time seems to pass goes as the square root of your age or something like that. But
and some things actually are quantifiable in terms of kind of these neuroscientific advancements and things that even aren't that new, like this idea of, for example, a part of your brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus that is going to respond specifically to light and increase your melatonin and actually cause you to want to sleep when it is dark out and cause you to be awake when it is light out. You put people into a cave, for example, and their clocks get weird. Sometimes right. they have like a 48-hour light-dark cycle in their minds because there is no light, but they think, has one day passed or is it two? Sometimes people sync up in really strange ways. And that's before we get into more, I think, into this interesting kind of psychological experience of time, I want to really talk more about this concept of clocks because I think it's really fascinating. I remember you mentioning that there's so many clocks all around us that really probably fed into how we first decided to keep time. The idea that your heartbeat is almost like a second.
Right.
And the idea that, you know, a day is the sun going down and coming back up every day. The idea that a lunar cycle, being able to follow the phases of the moon, are very similar to a month, right? Mm-hmm. And we can follow the seasonal patterns, and we know that we've traveled around the sun, that it's been a year. So even though these things are all, it's funny because these things are all very rooted in physics, the moon, the orbit of the Earth, the rotation of the Earth. And then some of them in our own biology, like our heartbeat, how did we first ultimately figure out how to synthesize these things into a parsing of time that actually made sense for us?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm probably not going to give you the historically accurate answer. That's as another different discipline there. But, you know, there are definitely steps along the way. When I did a little course for the teaching company on the nature of time, and they wanted, you know, when I wrote my book, I was talking about the physics of time and the arrow of time and entropy and the second law of thermodynamics.
In a second.
But they wanted stuff on clocks and calendars and things like that. So, I looked it up. And like you say, the lunar cycle is about a month, which is, of course, not an accident. That's what it was. Originally, it was exactly a month because that was the definition of the month between new moon and new moon. And the year does not divide easily into months of that form. And it's amazing the ingenuity that people put into coming up with calendar systems to make the lunar cycle match up. The Babylonians had this wonderful thing that is very similar to the Hebrew calendar today, where, you know, some years have 12 months, some have 13, and they're like a cycle of 7 and 6 or something.
So they
some
have ridiculous a leap month thing. Instead of a leap
day. Yeah, you have a leap
day,
month, right? So 3 years in a row, you have a leap month or something like that. And, you know, instead of, you know, these days we just hit the moon. Who cares about the moon? But if you're planting and so forth, the location of the moon might be very important. So we are all still living on a day-night cycle because we live in a world where the position of the sun in the sky still matters. We live in a world where the position of the moon in the sky doesn't matter at all, so who cares about the months? But, you know, once we move into space and land on Mars and live on the moon in the space station, the day-night cycle won't
completely
matter
different
anymore.
We'll so be like
24
on Mars
hours
time.
Might be completely optional. Like
maybe
different
souls.
People choose different daylight times.
Right, you see it, you saw it at the beginning when Curiosity first landed and all of the guys that were working, guys and girls, I should say, that were working on the Curiosity rover, they were living on Mars time. They had to work during the sol, not during the day, which was really effing up their relationships from what I hear. Can be tough. But what about the concept of an atomic clock? You know, a way that we can keep our clocks always right exactly on time. What is an atomic clock and how does it work?
Well, if a clock is something that does something predictable and repetitive compared to other clocks, atom, you know, the smaller you get, the more perfect and unmessed with you're going to be. So Galileo figured out that a rocking chandelier is a pretty good clock. And he did it because he was in church and the sermon was boring, and he actually timed the oscillations of a chandelier using his pulse. And so he was comparing those two clocks, the clock inside his heart and the clock in the chandelier, and he showed that from Sunday to Sunday, different amounts of variation in the position of the chandelier, but the time it took was always the same.
Interesting.
And you go down to atoms, and atoms are little vibrations, you know, just like a vibrating chandelier or a tuning fork, but they're more perfect. You know, they're less messed with by air currents or noise or imperfections or something like that. So we know of no more accurate practical timekeeping devices in terms of the number of oscillations being completely predictable than the vibrations of certain atoms in certain excited states. And so that lets us tell time to exquisite accuracy.
Wow. What about a subatomic clock? Would that not be more accurate?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it might be, but there's a whole other podcast we can do on this underappreciated thing that we're reaching the bottom of the individual pieces of which the universe is made, right? So we have atoms. Atoms are made of particles, subatomic particles. And so subatomic particles, like you imply, are even smaller than atoms. But to get them to vibrate and do something, they need to sort of be, you need to have at least two of them interacting mm-hmm. with each other, right? And so you might say, well, what about the smaller pieces out of which the subatomic particles are made out of? But we've reached the point now where even if there are smaller pieces, they're also heavier. And they're also unstable and they decay away, right? Mm. That's why it's hard to find the Higgs boson or something like that. The Higgs boson is 125 times as heavy as a proton. And you make it and it disappears within one zeptosecond.
Wow.
So we don't have access to new kinds of particles that are smaller and therefore even more accurate than an atom is. And
because they're not consistently there for us.
We never will.
Wow.
You had something for dinner last night and you remember what you had. You cannot right now make a choice to have had something for dinner last night. Now,
although
you
that
can,
would be nice.
It would be nice, but you can't do it. Yeah. Whereas you think you can make a choice about what to have for dinner tomorrow night and you don't remember what you had for dinner tomorrow night. So your access to the past and future is very different. We think the past has happened, it's in the books, we remember it, the future is sort of up for grabs, blah, blah, blah. And it's just such an obvious feature of the world that we don't think about it too much. Unless you're a physicist, and then you realize that the fundamental laws of physics draw no such distinction between the past and the future. If you're Isaac Newton and you're writing down the laws of mechanics that govern the motion of the planets or the falling of apples from trees, they treat the past and future completely indistinguishably. And one way of seeing this, if you imagine a very simple system with very few moving parts, no friction or anything like that, like a pendulum rocking back and forth, for example, and you make a movie of it, and you play the movie backwards and show it to someone, they won't know that you're playing it backwards.
Sure.
The motion looks the same, forward and backwards. And that seems to be like a special case because you went to a lot of effort to make something frictionless and pristine. But that's how every particle in the universe acts at a fundamental level. Everything obeys laws that work the same forward and backward in time.
But so, I mean, and tell me if this is a silly thing to be asking, but some forces, for example, maybe they are the same forwards and backwards in time, but directionally, are they not different? So if we talked about gravity, for example, gravity is going to be a force that draws things toward it. It doesn't repel things away from it. So there is some directionality to forces in physics, but maybe not temporal directionality.
So throw something up in the air, throw a baseball up in the air, make a movie of it going up and coming back down. Crop the movie so you don't see the person throwing it. Play it backwards. It looks exactly the same.
That's true. Right?
So, yes, it does. Gravity pulls things together, but you can be moving away or moving toward it in exactly the same way.
And the actual particles that are involved in this motion are indistinguishable. If you studied them going one direction, you studied them going the other direction.
That's right.
You would need to be told which direction they were going to understand the bigger picture.
Exactly. I mean, except for there's some footnotes there about the subatomic particles and things like that. But basically, yes. So this difference, this idea that causes and effects propagate toward the future, whereas memories propagate in the past. That's not a physics statement. It's not a fundamental physics statement. It's not a statement about the deep pieces of which reality is made. And so that's a puzzle, but it's a puzzle we know the answer to. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the answer was put together in the 19th century by people like Ludwig Boltzmann, the Austrian physicist, and also Maxwell and Thomson and others. And it's not the fundamental laws of physics that make the past and future different. It's the specific arrangement of stuff in our universe. Just like, you know, Carl Sagan says, that's where the beauty of the universe is. Well, that's also where the direction of time is.
And does that relate to this concept of entropy, this idea that things are orderly and become disorderly as they continue on?
It's exactly that. So entropy is just, informally, it's the messiness, the disorderliness, the disorganization ability of some collection of stuff. That's not really a word, by the way, yet the disorganization ability.
Yeah,
but you know what I mean. Entropy is the technical term we use to describe whether or not something is very ordered or very disordered. And low entropy means orderly, like all of the piles of paper on your desk are in neat little arrays, and high entropy is disorderly. The papers are all scattered all over the place.
And so if you kind of walked away, just natural things would cause those papers over time to become a little bit more askew. They're never going to straighten themselves back up naturally, but they are going to become more askew naturally.
That's exactly right. The tendency of things in the world is to become more and more disorderly, higher and higher entropy. And so when this thing was first noticed in the beginning of the 1800s, people thought that that was a new law of nature. And it's now called the second law of thermodynamics. It, left to themselves, things go from order to disorder. And much like temperature or pressure are now understood in terms of the arrangements of atoms in a fluid or solid or whatever, entropy is also now understood as a feature of the stuff that is doing the changing. It's not a thing all by itself. It's a way of characterizing other things. So we're made of atoms. We're made of particles doing their things. And it's not that there is some force or law of nature that pushes particles toward higher entropy. It's that they begin in configurations of low entropy, and there are more ways to be high entropy than low entropy. There's more ways to be scattered and disorderly than orderly and nicely arranged.
So this is almost, again, one of these concepts of like an emergent property of particles on their own. Like if we think about the Big Bang, right? The first 200,000 years after the Big Bang, everything was really opaque and pretty homogeneous, right? It was really hard to even know what was happening by looking at signatures in the universe because it was this thick soup. But then as the next 13 billion years occurred, things started to clump together. And then you see galaxies and you see suns and you see planets. And this was really just a bunch of matter sticking to each other. And now you have this really heterogeneous universe that at the beginning was quite homogeneous. Is that an example, like the ultimate example of entropy?
It's a very good example, but also a very confusing one. So let me just sort of slice it into pieces a little bit. What Boltzmann really figured out is that the reason why entropy goes up is because there are more ways to be high entropy than low entropy. Okay, it's not because entropy is a thing that grows with time. It's just the arrangements of stuff. And that is a perfectly good explanation of why the entropy of the universe will be higher tomorrow than it is today. There's more ways for the stuff to be arranged in a higher entropy configuration. But it doesn't what it does not explain is why the entropy of the universe was lower yesterday. So that's a puzzle. That's a puzzle we kind of don't know the answer to. The best answer we have, why the entropy was lower yesterday, is because it was even lower the day before yesterday.
Another one of those
even
circular explanations.
And it goes all the way back 13.8 billion years to
because
the Big Bang.
Because what caused, for example, the singularity, the thing that was before the Big Bang, to be so highly organized, so incredibly dense, so incredibly small? Like what made it have that kind of crystalline structure or whatever that structure might have been before this massive explosion?
That's exactly what we don't know and would like to know. Mm-hmm. Why was the Big Bang, why was the configuration of stuff in the universe at that time so low entropy, so highly organized? Because if low entropy it means there's only a few ways to organize things that way, and high entropy means there's many, many, many ways, the fact that the early universe had low entropy seems like a surprise. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's not going to happen by accident, right? So you can say that God did it that way, or you can be a scientist and say, I'm going to look for the laws of physics that explain why it was like that.
And continue to chase that. And we've actually seen some hypotheses. You know, Lawrence Krauss wrote a whole book about this idea of things kind of popping in and out of existence. And he thinks that this could potentially be an explanation. But one thing that I think is interesting is this concept moving from physics into the biological sphere, this concept of kind of self-assembling molecules, which has become a really big, I wouldn't say fad, but a really exciting new turn in material science, because a lot of really innovative scientists are thinking about how we can make new products that really kind of piggyback on what nature wants to do anyway, which is in some ways to, I think, an untrained eye, kind of thwarting entropy, right? This idea that there are certain molecules that have shapes to them that if they bounce around for long enough will fit one another like a lock and key, and then eventually things will start to grow from that. It's the way that drugs bind to our cells in our bodies, and ultimately they often fall out again depending on the affinity, how well they stick. But there are many, many, and we're seeing even more and more examples of this kind of self-assembly in nature, which to me seems almost like the opposite of entropy.
Well, it does seem that way, and this is a a hugely important point, which I think is actually going to be one of the great growth areas in physics, in science over the next 100 years, which is understanding how the fact that entropy goes up explains self-organization and other things. So the simple example that gives a little bit of clarity is mixing cream into coffee. This is a standard example of entropy increasing, right? If you have cream and it's separate from the coffee or it's sitting on top, then that's low entropy. It's organized. There's a small number of ways to do that. Once it's all mixed together, it's high entropy. Everything is completely mixed. So that's perfectly natural. You understand that in the second law of thermodynamics. But now shift your perspective a little bit from order versus disorder to simplicity versus complexity. That's a different question to ask, because you started in a configuration where all the cream was on the top, all the coffee was on the bottom. That's very simple, right? You ended where everything was mixed together, also very simple.
It was only complex as the mixing was occurring.
In between, when all the tendrils of cream were mixing into the coffee and it's looking turbulent and complicated, that's when the complexity came around. So entropy just goes up. Complexity goes up and then goes down again. It's a different kind of thing. And in fact, the reason why there can be complex structures, organization in that sense, that survive for a long time is because entropy is increasing. It's not despite the fact that entropy is increasing. So to give you another example, think about what happens when you put a ice cube in a glass of water or a bowl of water, and it melts. It very quickly goes away, right?
Sure.
So Erwin Schrödinger wrote the famous physicist, Schrödinger's cat guy, wrote a famous book called What is Life? And he says, what life is something that keeps going longer than it should have. And what he has in mind is compare that ice cube to what happens if you put a goldfish in the bowl. Now, if the goldfish were already dead, you know, it would eventually sort of decompose and equilibrate, become high entropy. But if you feed the fish and it's alive, it can stay in its sort of nice, organized way for a long time. So giving the fish food is giving the fish a low entropy source of energy, which it can then increase the entropy of. When you eat, when a plant photosynthesizes, you're taking low entropy energy and you're increasing its entropy. And that keeps you alive. So the origin of life is the same as the origin of these self-assembling things. They are relying on the fact that they are surrounded by low entropy, and their entropy is going down, but they're increasing the entropy of their environment to beat the band.
So we're kind of these little biochemical machines that have learned to adapt to these kind of fundamentals in physics.
We're parasites on the arrow of time. You know, entropy is increasing, and that's the only reason we're allowed to be here. Thinking thoughts, you know, having lives and aspirations. The only reason why we can persist and organize and create things is because the entropy of the universe used to be low, and it's going up, and we're riding the wave, and it's going to last about one Google years. And then we'll hit the maximum.
How many zeros is that?
That's 10 to the 100.
Wow.
That was the original Google before the search engine came along.
That's a lot of zeros.
So there's a number of years. And then after that, we think, to our best theories right now, the universe will just be empty space and it'll be dead forever.
Because at that point, there's all the stuff that was will be so spread out.
All the cream and the coffee
homogenous.
Have mixed together. And the universe is as boring and high entropy as it can
be. So we're still kind of in that fun in-between state where everything's clumped together. And like the tendrils of the coffee cream, there's a lot of activity, swirling.
That's right.
Activity.
It's not an accident that mixing cream into coffee looks like a galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
It's a self-assembly of something that is organized and pretty in the process of increasing its entropy.
But so since we've got this arrow of time that basically started at the Big Bang and has continually been moving forward, or maybe we could say outward, however you want to look at it, how does that relate then to this concept that there may be other universes? Are they potentially existing within that same structure with the same arrow of time? Are they ahead of us, behind us, moving backward, moving sideways? I mean, is it really just that like anything's possible? You know how a lot of people will say like, oh, but anything could be, you know, if we look like this on Earth, maybe there's the equal and opposite sulfur animal that looks like a green monster over here, like bizarro me with a beard and a mustache. Is it really true that anything is possible, or are there still parameters within the multiverse theory that say that the arrow of time, for example, still exists, or that these sort of physics principles still must apply?
The short answer, obviously, is we don't know. So I want to let people know that we've gone from talking about things we have a clue about to talking about things we're speculating about. But it's completely appropriate because, like I said, the part of the Arrow of Time story that we don't know the answer to is why our visible universe, which started with the Big Bang, had such a low entropy. If you think that the fundamental laws of physics have no difference in them between the past and the future, it's very puzzling that our actual universe has such a profound difference between past and future. Mm-hmm. And one way around that is to think that our observed universe is not all there is, that it's part of a much bigger structure. So my own favorite angle on this problem is to imagine that there is a multiverse, or at least that there's a much bigger structure than what we see. There's something before our universe. And if you go far enough into the past, there are other universes or other regions of the universe where the arrow of time moves in the other direction. Mm. So in other words, to imagine a structure where there's a middle point where entropy is relatively low, but it is higher in both directions, both future and past from that. Now, that's not a full explanation. You still need to understand why there's a middle point at all, but at least the whole thing is symmetric, right? It's not an imbalance between past and future. So if you want to believe something like that, the challenge is to apply some equations to it, to really build a physical model in which that naturally happens. So I did that, 10 years ago with Jennifer Chen, a graduate student of mine, and I'm working right now with Alan Guth, the inventor of the inflationary universe scenario, to sort of update that and figure out the general framework in which ideas like this could happen. So the eventual goal of thinking about things like this is to explain why our early universe looks the way it does rather than some other way. And we're nowhere near that yet. We just don't, it's not that we can't put our ideas to the test, it's that our ideas are not yet that mature.
Sure.
We don't know what they predict, but that's certainly what we want.
But with this idea of the inflationary kind of universe model, is it the concept that these other universes already have been or are existing at the same time as we are existing?
Already have been is probably not logically accurate construction because it's hard to talk about these things because our vocabulary is laden with time words. So the simplest way out is for a physicist to think of the entire four-dimensional reality, or at least the entirety of the history of the universe, however dimensions of space there might have been, but the entire history of the universe from far past to far future, think of it all at once. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when I say all at once, I don't mean at the same moment in time, because that's not what it means.
You don't mean look at a cross section across all of the universe.
No, and I don't mean that it all exists at the same time either. I mean that is reality. That, we have this intuitive way of thinking about reality as the now, and we're moving through time, and the past, it might be fixed and in the books, but it's not real like the present is, and certainly the future is not real like that. But a physicist wants to say, actually, every moment in time is equally real.
Yeah.
That you, the complete description of you, is a history from the moment you're born to the moment you die, and there's sort of all the individual moments along the way, and the universe is the same way. So it's not that these other universes with other arrows of time exist next to ours now.
Yeah.
They are in our past because they're in the direction of time where entropy was lower. But from their point of view, we are in their past.
Sure.
Because there's no...
Because we're moving away from a central kind of point.
The difference between past and future is not fundamental. It's not universal. So we call something the past and they call the opposite.
So then how does this relate to the idea that I think some people have been exposed to of this kind of soap bubble model, this idea that there are these sort of self-contained universes that sometimes can collide with one another and maybe we can get some sort of data from them in that way?
Well, that's a version of it, right? So when we talk about the multiverse in cosmology, we're not talking about any one coherent idea. There's lots of different versions of the multiverse. So the version that I thought about 10 years ago was one where there were literally bubbles of universe that separated off from the bigger universe and never could collide, never could talk to the rest of the universe ever again. Whereas there's actually a much more tractable version where when you talk about a bubble, it's a region inside space that just grows and takes up more and more space, like a physical bubble.
Like the universe itself that we think about as being that's ever expanding.
And if that were true, then you know there's a direction of space you could go into and go into another universe. And that universe, quote-unquote universe, could bump into us, leave a trail behind, you know, leave some signature that we might be able to someday detect in the relic radiation from the Big Bang.
The problem is then what we're actually fighting against is this concept of time and entropy, right? Because if something is ultimately so far away from us and we are limited by our own place in the universe, we may never be able to reach this thing that may always remain theoretical in our minds.
Yeah, we may never. And I think that as scientists, as cosmologists, we have to accept that there might be some fundamental limitations. But we can't be discouraged by that because we don't know how far we're going to get. We right now have data that tells us what the universe was doing 1 second after the Big Bang on the basis of the nuclear reactions that were going on. We are hopeful. In fact, there's a rumor, if you follow the Twitter feeds of various cosmologists, there's a rumor that Monday we will hear about data that tells us about the first tiny, tiny fraction of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, when inflation was happening. And that's harder to put together. But, you know, once we get the data, we can think about it in a much more specific and guided way. And it's a dialectic between thinking about things, coming up with ideas, and then going out there and looking at the data. So, yes, it might be that these are scenarios which we'll never be able to tell which one is right. But we're nowhere near the point where we should be giving up on that yet.
Well, we are actually running low on time, unfortunately, and there's a couple of things I want to hit, maybe briefly, and maybe this will give me an excuse to get you back on the podcast again in the future. So for those of you who don't know, those of you who do maybe, Sean is a very outspoken atheist, like myself, and I think we have a lot of things that we agree upon. We have a couple things we don't, but Sean recently engaged in a debate. I know most of you kind of remember that Bill Nye and Ken Ham had a very public debate, but Sean recently, what was the date of your debate? Do you remember?
Sometime
in the end of February.
Maybe?
And who were you debating?
It was William Lane Craig, who is a very famous Christian apologist. So if you know any Christian apologists, then he's probably one of the ones who you would know. He sort of makes a living, or at least made his reputation, going around debating people. He'll debate other Christians, he'll debate atheists, he'll debate about specific questions about biblical theology or about cosmology or about morality or what have you. And he's very good at debating, at the craft of debating. He is quite accomplished. So he usually wins his debates. And if you read, you know, there's a lot of atheist blogs or websites out there that will just tell you, don't even think that you could debate William Lane Craig, even if you think you're right. He's just much, much better than you are.
And so what made you think you could debate him?
Well, I thought I was right. And I think that, you know, in some sense, I was well positioned to debate him. I mean, certainly he's much more practiced at it than I was, and I respect that. I mean, I certainly don't think that I am as used to that exact format as he is. But we were both invited separately. It was not his idea or my idea. We were invited to have a debate about God and cosmology.
Okay.
And his most famous argument philosophically is what is called the cosmological argument for the existence of God, the idea that the universe had a beginning. If something has a beginning, something needs to cause it, and then that cause is going to be God. There's different versions of it, but that's the basic idea. So he draws on a lot of modern contemporary cosmology to make that case. And I think that, you know, to explain in a debate format why he is not correct, because I don't think he's correct about the conclusions he draws, to explain that, I think, number one, you need to have, you know, experience public speaking, so you can get up there and do that.
Definitely.
Number two, you need to know the modern cosmology very well. Mm-hmm. And number three, you need to have at least some philosophical background, because he is a philosopher, and, you know, a lot of physicists, almost all physicists, get by perfectly well being completely ignorant about philosophy. And that's fine. You don't need it to do physics, right?
But you definitely need the rhetoric
to be able to debate about the beginning
that's
of the
true.
Universe. Yes.
So how, I mean, in your view, how do you think that that went? And also, how would you compare that to kind of what happened with Bill Nye and Ken Ham? Like, did you think that that specific example was a good idea? There's a lot of debate in the scientific community about whether Bill Nye should have done it, about whether he shouldn't. Now there's information that's been released that Ken Ham is able to use some of the funds that were raised from doing this very public debate to continue to build an ark, which is insane, to continue with his kind of creation museum. So in your mind, like, how would you compare these two scenarios?
They're more or less completely different, I think. You know, I was a little skeptical about Bill Nye versus Ken Ham. In the end, it was probably a good thing because I think Bill Nye apparently did a very good job. I'll confess I didn't see it.
Yeah.
But I'm told by people who would be critical that he did fairly well. But, you know, it's just a circus show, right?
It did. It felt like it was stacked against him from the beginning because he was very much on Ken Ham's turf with Ken Ham's audience. Ken Ham was making a lot of money off of it. And granted, I'm sure Bill got paid well for it, too. I mean, it was probably both a public service, kind of, but also part of his job.
Right.
You know, we do things. That's how science communicators make money, is they give talks.
Yep.
Maybe they engage in debates. But it's been a very mixed, I feel like, review of the situation. For me, it was very hard to watch.
What I thought was, I was disappointed that so many people who I do respect and care about seemed to care about this debate so much.
Sure.
I mean, you know, fine, have it, but who cares? I mean, you're not learning anything. It's just a circus show.
And that's, for me, you know, that's why I really couldn't watch. It's not like he was going to tell me anything I didn't already know.
Exactly.
And it was just very painful to watch Ken Ham kind of try and come up with his response. It was just the same shit we're so used to hearing.
And there's no, it's not an interesting issue. It's not interesting, like, gee, is the Earth 6,000 years old?
I know.
That's just not that interesting.
That's so different than this idea of, like, what came before the Big Bang,
right,
and whether or not the idea of God is a necessary and useful idea in the context of modern physics.
Right. And I think that, you know, say what you will about William Lane Craig, but he believes the universe is 14 billion years old.
Exactly.
He believes there's evolution. He believes there's a Big Bang. And there are, even though I'm completely atheistic, I think that it's an interesting question to ask, are the fine-tuned parameters that we observe in the universe, or is the very beginning of the universe something that could plausibly be better explained by invoking the existence of God? That's a perfectly respectable question, unlike, is the universe more than 6,000 years old?
Completely. And that's where, when people kind of give me shit for being an outspoken atheist, and I've really been trying to come to terms, you know, after reading Chris Mooney's book, Unscientific America, where he really kind of is outspoken about the new atheist movement and how it's very detrimental to science education, and trying to sit with that and I don't know, just come to terms on my own. To me, I feel like there's a big difference between talking about people who are religious and talking about people who are fundamentalist, creationist, intelligent design advocates. So there's this concept of being able to reconcile religion with a scientific worldview that I think many people do quite well. I can't personally do it, but I respect and understand that some people can. But when the science takes a back seat to belief and to faith, that's when I have a problem. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people who do that aren't doing it in any sort of malicious way. They're doing it in a way that they haven't been exposed to the science. And we both know, and this is another conversation we could have, that the deficit model doesn't really work. That the idea of just like, well, let me teach you more and cram more down your throat just makes people go, I'm not interested. But being able to approach the in-betweeners, the people who don't really quite understand the science, would prefer maybe a pseudo-creationist worldview because it seems more realistic or more reasonable to them. But somehow, if they were exposed to this kind of universe a little bit more, it's like a little bit of sugar with the medicine, eventually being able to see both sides and maybe perhaps never shaking religion. I have no interest in helping people move away from religion unless they've already decided to do that. You know what I mean? Like, I definitely have an interest in working with other people in sort of more ex-Mormon support groups. And, you know, that's the world I came from. But definitely people who are perfectly fine with religion and science, I think that there's room for that. And I would never want to be somebody who shits on that kind of a worldview. Unfortunately, there are people out there who are actively working to delegitimize science, especially in the public arena, in politics, in education. That is problematic.
So I think I have we're at 98% level of agreement here, but not 100%, because I think that you're completely right. Different audiences require different strategies. And to the audience who believes Ken Ham and thinks that the universe is 6,000 years old, facts and debates are never going to have any impact. I mean,
yeah,
it is just the circus show. Whereas people who are interested in the more academic philosophical discussion about how best to explain the features of the world that we do know about, then I think that a debate might actually serve a better purpose. But in a broader, and I should say parenthetically, you know, there are good scientists who really think that God played a crucial role,
mm-hmm,
in how the world works. Francis Collins and Ken Miller think that God helps decide which quantum mechanical coin flip happens to guide the course of evolution. And that's completely incompatible with the laws of physics, but they don't appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I think that is where my fellow physicists and philosophers I disagree with, some of them, because many of them, you know, for example, I won't try to take money directly from the Templeton Foundation,
sure.
which is a philanthropic organization that gives money hopefully to sort of blur the lines between science and religion. And a lot of people say, well, you know, I'll just take it to do my thing. They're not forcing me to be religious, which is true. But what I try to say is this. When we think about the fundamental nature of reality, what happened at the Big Bang? What are the laws of nature? What are the fundamental particles of which we're made? That kind of thinking that I think is very valuable, nevertheless, has almost no direct impact on people's lives. It does not cure disease. It does not help you lose weight or buy a house or anything like that. Except it affects your fundamental view of what life is. It does matter to your view of who you are in the world, what the purpose of your life is, what will happen after you die, to know that there are laws of physics that explain the motion of the atoms and that you are made of atoms, and we know what those laws of physics are. It affects your position in the world to know that we live in a galaxy with 100 billion stars and there's 100 billion other galaxies out there. And to think that all of these hundreds of billions of galaxies were made just so that we could be here is not really plausible. So I think that that's the one way in which fundamental physics and philosophy and cosmology can affect people's everyday lives. So we shouldn't hide it. So
definitely
we need
not.
To be out there
and we shouldn't
making
pretend,
this point as loudly as we can.
We shouldn't pretend like this is somehow offensive to people who have a religious worldview, that somehow there is this kind of profound reverence that we're supposed to have, and that just because a physical worldview, for example, is threatening to somebody's religious sensibilities, that we should keep our mouth shut. And this is, for me, the big movement in atheism that I'm so interested in, and this is why we actually did a piece for The Point, the Young Turks channel. You were on that panel with me. We did an hour-long piece. Look it up. It's gotten a lot of really good feedback, some not so good feedback. But this is why I decided I don't want to do a debate here. I want to have three atheists and myself sit down and talk about what it means to be atheist, why we are completely moral beings, and that our worldview is a worldview that should have a voice, whether it be in politics, in education, or just in everyday life, coming out from behind those shadows and being able to talk about people without fear of kind of, you know, retribution from people, really.
Yeah, and I think that among naturalists, as I like to think of myself, someone who believes that there's the natural world and no supernatural world, I think that's a better sort of constructive way of thinking about the worldview than just atheist, which is sort of what we're not.
Yeah.
That's why I put together this workshop that you can find out about on my webpage called Moving Naturalism Forward. And I brought together Richard Dawkins, Steven Weinberg, Daniel Dennett, Rebecca Goldstein, Jerry Coyne, a bunch of people who all already agreed that naturalism was right. So we're not debating religious people. Not that that's not a useful thing to do also, but look, there's a lot of questions we don't know the answers to, okay? From free will to morality to emergent complexity and evolution and the second law of thermodynamics. So we need to, among those of us who already agree on the basic picture of reality, we're nowhere near caught up to where we thought we were 500 years ago in terms of what does it mean to live a good life, a meaningful life, a fulfilled life? Why are we here? Those kinds of questions. I think there are answers to those kinds of questions, but we don't have them yet. And if we spend all of our time arguing about Noah's Ark, we're going to get there a lot more slowly.
And this multidisciplinary approach, taking biologists and physicists and chemists and philosophers who all kind of agree and looking at their areas of expertise and figuring out how all of these things can build upon one another, I think is such an important approach that we're seeing across modern science, is this idea of like, you can't exist in a vacuum anymore. You have to learn from other people, talk to other people, and help inform their decisions so that ultimately this concept of these unified theories, whether they're in physics or whether they're across life, I think we can start to approach even more. All right, so we're basically out of time, but I have been ending all of my podcasts by asking two very distinct questions. questions. And I just think it's fun to see what everybody's different answers are. And the first one is thinking about the future, which is really funny since we've been talking about time this whole time. But thinking about the future, what are you first most concerned about looking forward? And second, most excited about?
Depends on how long of the future we're talking about. In a Google years, I'm just concerned about entropy. Uh-huh. That's the only thing that I can worry about. But in the more near future, you know, there's just the obvious answers, I think, about the shape of the Earth, right? Climate change and the environment. I think that if I were trying to give a more clever answer, I might think about the relationship between technological advancement and inequality, mm-hmm. in the sense that this goes back into what I'm most optimistic about. What I'm most optimistic about is that our development of science and technology is just beginning. And, you know, we're going to, in the next 1,000 years, what we're going to see is going to put the last 1,000 years to shame. And an obvious thing that we might be able to do is to live forever, or to live for at least thousands or millions of years. You know, there's no law of physics that says that we can't clean up every individual cell in your body and let you live for as long as you want to live. And that changes lives in a very profound way. And if they do invent that, some people are going to get it first, yeah. and some people are not. And that's what I'm most worried about. I mean, that's a very, very dramatic example. But the, you know, the inequality of life is something that is very dramatic in our current world. And we have the ability to fix it. I mean, we have the resources in the world so that no one should live in poverty or die of malaria or anything like that. And do we have the collective willpower to do those sorts of global scale things? And so my worry is that we don't. My hope is we do.
I think that's wonderful. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sean. Tell the people who are listening right now where they can read more about your work, where they can tweet you, Facebook you, whatever. Where on the interwebs are you living?
So it's very easy to Google Sean Carroll, and there's two famous scientists with that name. My evil twin, Sean B. Carroll, is the one with the beard, so that's why we know he's the evil twin. He's a biologist who writes wonderful books, and I can recommend you buy them after you buy Sean M. Carroll's books. Those are mine. I have my own website at preposterousuniverse.com, where I have my papers and things like that, and also a blog that I update regularly. And I'm on Twitter at Sean M. Carroll.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. And hey, everybody, thank you for tuning in. I am looking forward to the next time when we get together to talk nerdy.